This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, here on New Books in East European Studies. And today, my guest is a historian, Pavel Markiewicz, who's joining us from Warsaw to talk about his new book and his first book, Unlikely Allies, Nazi German and Ukrainian Nationalist Collaboration in the General Government During World War II, published by Purdue University Press 2021. First of all, Pavel, congratulations on your great book. It's a pleasure to have you today.
Thanks so much, Stephen. It's a pleasure to be here with you and with everybody listening.
So a little bit about our author, and then we'll get right into the book. Pavel Markiewicz is currently Chief Specialist Analyst in the International Security Program at the Polish Institute of International Affairs in Warsaw, Poland. A native of Revere, Massachusetts, he completed his undergraduate studies at Salem State College before receiving a master's degree from Harvard University's School of Continuing Education and Extension Studies graduate program. In 2019, he successfully earned his doctorate in modern Central East European history at Jagiellonian University in Kraków, Poland. His research interests include topics in 20th century East Central European history, nationalist movements in the region, Polish-Ukrainian studies, Ukrainian-German relations, and Polish diaspora issues, among others. He's lectured or spoken at events in Poland, the Czech Republic, Ukraine, and the United States. Dr. Markiewicz was a visiting scholar at the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Ukrainian Studies in Kyiv and at Salem State University's Center for the Study of Holocaust and Genocide before completing a visiting fellowship at Harvard University's Ukrainian Research Institute, HURI. And he's contributed articles and reviews to such journals as Slavonic and East European Review, Canadian Slavonic Papers, The Polish Review, Jahrbücher für Geschichte Osteuropas, Jaunej Nowsze, and Polski Przegląd Dyplomatyczny, while providing commentaries including to the Rzeczpospolita and Gazeta Wyborcza newspapers. So I want to ask you a lot of questions, Pavel, about this book. I am so excited to talk to you about diplomatic history and in all of these complicated relationships during World War II. My first question for you is simply a question of motivation. What was it that motivated you to get involved in this research?
You know, that would have to be a tip of my hat to my former dissertation advisor at the Jagiellonian University, Dr. Jan Bruski, who, when I came to the doctoral program, and when I came to be his student, suggested the topic to me of Kubiyovich, the Ukrainian Central Committee, this idea of looking at German-Ukrainian cooperation in the general government. He brought it up to me in a very subtle way, of course, suggesting that I kind of do some of my own research on the topic to see what's already been written about it and what hasn't been written about it. And when I began that kind of self-research, I noticed that this is a very important topic, not only to the region, but also to the historiography of the Second World War itself. And that there still lacks, or there lacked at least at that time, a comprehensive understanding of the topic. And that's what really convinced me that this is something that's, number one, important to pursue, and number two, worthwhile to write about.
I think that's a really good place to start, because there's so many entanglements in the story that you tell, that this is really a project of Histoire Croisée or gekreuzte Geschichte, right? And maybe you could give our listeners an idea of who Kubejevich is. Who is this tall, bald, bespectacled geographer, ethnographer? I'm not really quite sure what we can call him. Who was Volodymyr Kubejevich?
Well, that's that's a really good question to start out with. And reading his memoirs that he wrote in 1970 and 1980, he kind of almost had a difficult time, writing who he was about himself, right? First and foremost, he made sure to underscore that he wasn't a Lemko or someone from the Lemko diaspora, Lemko community, but he made sure to note that he was Ukrainian. It's interesting, though, that, he identifies himself in that way, because he grew up in a very almost a common type of family scenario at the time, where his father was a Ruthenian or Ukrainian and his mother was Polish. So he grew up in this split ethnic household, and that he wrote about extensively in his memoirs, that he was exposed to, for example, the classic Ukrainian works of Shevchenko. He was exposed to the history of Ukraine by Hrushevsky from his father. But on the flip side, he was also exposed to Sienkiewicz and the trilogy by his mother. So he had this almost dual track identity growing up. And I think historian Frank Golcheski nailed this on the head when he said, growing up in this kind of milieu where you have this mixed ethnicity, you are able to almost self-choose what you want to be, right? It's not always forced upon you. And as he grew up and as he grew older, living in the Second Polish Republic, given its changing policy towards the Ukrainian community, the Ukrainian minority at the times, he kind of gravitated more towards that Ukrainian identity than the Polish one. So he would go from being Włodzimierz Kubejevich to Volodymyr Kubejevich, changing in that sense, making more contact with the Ukrainian community outside of Kraków, where he spent a lot of his time, going to Lviv or Lvov at that time, in exchanging thoughts and ideas with a lot of the intellectuals there, greatly helped him self-identify as Ukrainian rather than Polish. Of course, his intellectual track, like you mentioned, Stephen, if he's a geographer, ethnographer, his intellectual track was really motivated by those types of topics. I think at one point he called himself an anthropological geographer.
Exactly. Yeah. So, like Rotzel.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Which is really an interesting type of understanding. But, if we look back and see the works that he wrote, especially, during his doctoral studies, soon after, it would make sense that he kind of identified himself in that way, where he wrote about the physical characteristics of some of the mountain ranges where Poles and Ukrainians lived in southeastern Poland, as well as the communities that lived there. So it was this kind of geographical, anthropological mindset that he had as well.
Yeah, I think that's really important. And you mentioned his mixed ethnic origins and how, he had grown up speaking both Polish and Ukrainian. I want to come back to Kubejevich because I have a lot of questions about him and his very long life from 1900 to 1985 and his involvement in the general government. But I wanted to ask you another very big question in the way that you set up your book and your chapters, and maybe you can introduce those to us as well. And that is, who are these unlikely allies? Who are your big states, let's say, in this book?
Yeah, well, just going through the way that I kind of set it up, I started off kind of giving a background of Polish-Ukrainian relations from the end of the First World War up until the Second World War, because, of course, that's critical to understanding the wartime situation in the general government. And I followed that up with this understanding of Ukrainian-German relations also in that same time period for the same reason, right? Because those three vectors, the Polish, German, Ukrainian, certainly intersect, and they intersect very hard once the war breaks out. So I figured that it would be important to kind of start off with those two. And of course, then I go into, the war itself, where Kubiyovich finds himself, what the German policy is, the occupational policy is, once the Polish state ceases to exist, the Polish country ceases to exist, which I'm assuming that we'll talk about very shortly.
Yes.
And then, just kind of a chronological path to seeing how the relationship formed between, the German, the Nazi German administration and the general government and the ethnic groups that they controlled. And, my focus was, of course, on the Ukrainian ethnic group and how that relationship affected, how the Poles saw things.
Right.
So that's kind of the big picture. And, that lasted from mid-October 1939, when the general government was set up, until, the beginning of January 1945, when Hans Frank drove out of Kraków in flight of the Soviet advance. Mm-hmm. So it's a very expansive time frame, which covered pretty much the entire war.
I wonder, Pavel, if we might work from the center of your book out and maybe to the beginning and to the end. So what would you call the centerpiece of your book, topically or maybe just in terms of year? Is it September 1939? Is that the most influential moment? Is it the Pilsudski coup in 1927, which you talk about as well? I'm really interested in how you're framing the Polish-Ukrainian relationship, because there's so much historiography, and you could introduce that too, because you cover so much of it. But my question for you is what the sort of heart of the book is for you. What's the center of it?
Well, I think, one of the things that I was really, what I really tried to get across, when I was researching this and coming up with the materials and seeing what was in the archival documents and things along those lines, was to show how the cooperation between Kubiyovich and his Ukrainian Central Committee on the one hand and the German occupation administration on the other, how that affected the relationship between everyday Ukrainians and Poles as far away as, in the Helm region of the Lublin district, or, in Lviv, Lemberg, under German occupation. And that for me was very important, because I had a strong conviction that the German aspect in all of this was missing in a lot of the historiography that discusses the Polish-Ukrainian relationship during the Second World War, especially in the general government. And that's what I really wanted to fall back on and show, that there was this motivating factor, or this third factor, that employed what can be, regarded as the quintessential imperialist colonizing style of divide and rule that up until about mid-1943 worked very successfully for the Germans and the general government. I mean, we can't really question that. It worked for the most part quite well. Once the front started to break in the east, and then of course, once the partisan activity really heated up behind German lines in the general government, well, that's when things started to really get messy. But up until about mid-1943, this policy that Hans Frank was very, very vehement in employing of divide and rule was worked well.
Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking about the moment that you talk about when you really get into the meetings of Ukrainians with Germans in places like Kraków, of how this brutal policy or process of Germanization was triggered. And of course, that this is the establishment of the general government for occupied Polish territories. As you mentioned, it's the full title for the general government. So I wonder if you might, from that point in, let's say, October, November 1939, introduce some of the other characters and then what the German, especially the German-Ukrainian relationship is. So, you know, who is Hans Frank? What does he do? And then how do the Ukrainians get involved with him?
Sure. Well, Hans Frank, of course, former or one-time attorney for the National Socialists. He defended many of the imprisoned Nazis during the interwar period in Munich, and he became a fairly close confidant of Hitler's. And he was chosen to lead this, you know, quasi-state creation that became the general government. And just, you know, just to give kind of this mental idea of what the general government was, it was what we could consider today to be central Poland, central in parts of eastern Poland, that was formed into this quasi-administrative unit. And then, you know, the territories of southeastern Poland that went up to Lviv, what would today be present-day Lviv, was also included after 1941. So this was this conglomeration of land that was inhabited by Poles, Ukrainians, Jews, of course, and some other ethnic groups. The creation of the general government forced many of the administrators that came in with Hans Frank and that whole apparatus to think about what to do with the whole, what to do with the minority issue, right? Before the war, Poland was a very large minority state, with the Ukrainian minority being the largest at about 15-16%, a large Jewish minority, of course, Germans, and many others. So the question was what to do with all this. Well, following the racial doctrine of the Nazis, the whole social apparatus was flipped upside down, one could almost say, where Jews and Poles, who were very, very populous, were placed at the bottom of the ladder. The Germans that came in were placed at the top as the administrators. Any of the Volksdeutsche were kind of, you know, right under them as loyal Germans. And in the middle, what we had were the Ukrainians, you know, some of the Belarusians that also inhabited some of those eastern parts of the general government, and the Highlanders as well, the Guralan folk, right, that were seen as these elements that, you know, the administration could somehow work with in order to marginalize the Poles and Jews even more, right? So that was one of the key aspects in this whole occupational apparatus, was to use these groups, or to not only use them, but to shave them away, right, from the larger Polish nationality, by recognizing by doing what the interwar Polish government failed to do, recognizing them as being ethnically distinct rather than just being Poles. And that's what motivated many of these groups to fall into line and work with the German occupation.
Yeah, I want to follow up on that, Pavel, because I think you have a really interesting argument about Kubiewicz and how he pitches the welfare project. Could you talk a little bit about this intersection maybe of the racial state with all of its hierarchies, where Poles fall, where Ukrainians fall, with Kubiewicz as sort of an intermediary? It's a very fascinating idea that he's pitching the welfare project to Ukrainians, of course, right? And it does this, you know, in meetings and things like that in Krakow. Could you explain through your sources how you get at that issue?
Yeah, I mean, what's really interesting is that, you know, when the Germans decided that they would organize these welfare committees, a Polish welfare committee, which was the Rada Główna Opiekuńcza, is what it was called, the Ukrainian one, the Ukrainian Central Committee, obviously, and then there was a short-lived Jewish welfare committee up until about 1941. This idea came about from the German side because they obviously weren't going to give these groups any political recognition, but they still wanted to have these groups around as a means of giving them some kind of representation so they knew what was going on within these communities first and foremost, as an added kind of set of eyes and ears. But to also, you know, use these ethnic welfare committees as an added means of dividing and ruling among the ethnic groups. And I think that's also something that's very important to add here. Now, when Kubiyovich was chosen to lead the committee, it's interesting because one of the main German requirements was that the leader of the Ukrainian Central Committee had to be someone endemic to the general government, not someone that came from outside the general government like so many Ukrainians did at that time. About 30,000 Ukrainians came into the general government fleeing Soviet occupation. So you had a lot of the Ukrainians from Lviv and those areas, the very well-educated Ukrainians that were coming in, as well as the very nationally conscious Ukrainians, ones that were zealous nationalists, even adhering to the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists. You also had democratic Ukrainians from the UNDO party, the Ukrainian Democratic National Party. So you had this wide spectrum of Ukrainians coming in, but the Germans made a point of it that the man that would lead this whole organization would have to be someone endemic. So the decision fell on Kubiyovich as someone that was that could work with many of these individuals who had a broad understanding, for the most part, of the Ukrainian community, especially in the general government area, and someone that had that nationalist drive as well. Now, what's important to add here is that the Germans obviously created the whole legal apparatus for the central committees, the welfare committees, and so on. What they added for the Ukrainian to the Ukrainian one was this idea of cultural welfare. And this is something that Kubiyovich really successfully exploits.
That's interesting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Throughout mm-hmm. the time in the general government. Whereas, you know, Poles were unable to, Polish culture was completely banned in every sense of the way, from schools being closed to the universities to, of course, the famous incident where the professors of the Jagiellonian University were taken off to Sachsenhausen and imprisoned there. So Polish culture was completely gone. But as what I call a token concession to the Ukrainians, the Germans felt that they could gain more loyalty from them by offering them, for example, what was stipulated as these cultural concessions. So Ukrainians had a vast network of elementary schools, vocational schools in the general government. There was the Ukrainian newspaper, the publishing house that functioned very well at the time as well. And they were given all these types of concessions. Now, Kubiyovich saw this as vital to not only... He saw this vital for two reasons. First of all, for him, these cultural concessions and working in this way to... Or using them, exploiting these cultural concessions, allowed him, or at least he thought, this was his vision, would allow him to kind of pick up the national consciousness of the Ukrainians in the general government, especially in areas like the eastern parts of the Lublin district, for example, where these Ukrainians were mixed. They were second, third, fourth generation, where they spoke more Polish than Ukrainian. But Kubiyovich claimed that even if they have a drop of Ukrainian blood in them, they're still Ukrainian, and we have to work on these people to raise their national consciousness, to kind of create this Ukrainian community out of all these people. And that kind of links with the second reason that he sought to do this, was because that was something that he could use to then claim that the territories inhabited by these people were in fact ethnographically Ukrainian, which means that they belong to some kind of either Ukrainian state in the future or a Ukrainian autonomous territory within the general government. There were these various visions of what that would mean, but that's kind of the large or the broad scope of what Kubiyovich saw by this kind of cultural welfare, right? To create or recreate these Ukrainians, and to also, you know, kind of catch up to the point at least where they were during the interwar period before going on this kind of offensive, if you will.
Right, right. I mean, I understand the nature of the project and how he's, you know, framing himself as a kind of almost like an exceptionalist. I don't know if that's the right word, but he is stressing the uniqueness of Ukrainian ethnography and territory. And it's all the more ironic given his biography, his marriages, all of those sorts of things. I have another question for you, and this is because of so much work being done on Oun and you know, Bandera and Melnik, and I'm thinking back to Tim Snyder's work, obviously, but others like Christoph Meek and Tariq Amar and Grzegorz Rosolinski-Liebe and Jean-Paul Himka and many others I'm sure you can mention. But, I mean, what is the relationship between the central government that Kubiyovich is running and Oun? He's thinking, right, that the central government is bigger, better, that it sort of outflanks or maybe frames the Oun. What is that relationship?
You know, it's a very interesting relationship because you can almost break it down into two parts, right? The first part is the actual, you know, relationship where they're working together. And then the second part is kind of where some of them go in their separate ways. And let me just explain that. Up until 1941, right, before the German invasion of the Soviet Union, the crux of the work of the Ukrainian Central Committee and Kubiyovich was in the general government, in those parts of the general government that obviously didn't extend farther east. This was a time where, as I mentioned before, many of those Ukrainians that came into the general government in 1939, 1940 were nationally conscious, belonging to the organization of Ukrainian nationalists, you know, to either the more radical Bandera faction, to the more moderate Melnik faction. But they were there. And Kubiyovich depended on many of these Oun members to staff his local committees, you know, at the city level, the municipal level, at the county level, to be these stewards of Ukrainian nationalism and Ukrainian national consciousness at the lower level. So he worked with, you know, what would be the whole Oun organization, both factions. Now, you know, if we you know, look a little further, we can say that by the way that he, you know, pursued, for example, his you know, political agenda, that he leaned more towards the Melnik faction, which was the faction that the faction of Oun that propagated closer collaboration, cooperation with the Germans in order to reach the goal of a Ukrainian state. You know, there were even conversations between Kubiyovich and representatives of the Central Committee with Melnik and many of his top officials where the two sides came almost to a gentleman's agreement, right? That
that's an interesting phrase. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That, you know, the Ukrainian Central Committee would be the exponent of the organization of Ukrainian nationalists, which was obviously, you know, illegal in the general government. Right. So it would be this exponent. Kubiyovich would promote Melnik to general government officials in the future, which he did in many notes in 1941, especially when things were getting hot and when it was becoming obvious that there would be this attack or invasion into the Soviet Union. Kubiyovich sent many letters, signed many letters in which, you know, he said that, you know, Andriy Melnik would be the future leader of Ukraine. He supported that idea. And, you know, through these negotiations, Kubiyovich promised not to supersede the authority of Oun, right? He'd be the spokesman in the general government, but he wouldn't supersede them. Now, a problem that arose in all of this was the fact that, you know, when the two factions, the Bandera faction and the Melnik faction, were at loggerheads at the top level, that transplanted also to the bottom and local levels. So within these little Ukrainian committees, you know, in villages, in townships, and in cities throughout eastern Poland and southeastern Poland, Kubiowicz began getting these notes saying that, well, we're having problems because Melnikites that are running this central committee are excluding Banderite supporters from the central committee, and they're starting infighting, and this whole scuffle starts to break out, which he has to extinguish very quickly, especially because the Germans are pressing him to do so, because that's obviously upsetting certain kind of, you know, upsetting the harmony of occupation, if you will. So he's forced to almost take a side, and he takes the German side here, where he cleans house in a lot of these pivotal local committees, throwing out either Bandera supporters, Melnik supporters, replacing them with kind of these moderate nationalists that he can rely on. And that comes at a time which is very fortuitous as well for Kubiowicz. It comes in 1941, just before and right after the German invasion. So he cleans house, and a lot of those nationalists head east anyway. And it works out for him in that sense. Now, just to quickly add here, the Bandera faction, it's interesting, reading a lot of what they say, they view Kubiowicz as a national, almost a national traitor and collaborator in the worst sense, because obviously it goes against their agenda, which was, an agenda that was based on also working with the Germans at one point, but then it completely switched 360 degrees by 1942, right? But throughout the whole war, Kubiowicz is seen by them as this almost type of national traitor who continues to, you know, work with the Germans, given everything that they're doing, everything that's going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have two big questions about this so-called Kubiowicz action and how it's viewed, what you're mentioning. The one question, I guess, is Kubiowicz ruling as a kind of Führer? This is a very pointed question because so far we haven't used the F word fascist, right, in describing SS Galitzin and other things. And the second part of this is using your sources, because you go back to Krakiwski Visti. How is Kubiowicz perceived? I mean, how is the Kubiowicz action perceived by the Germans and then, of course, by the Poles, both in the underground and the government in exile?
You know, it's interesting because certainly the way that Kubiowicz is perceived varies, obviously, among the different ethnic groups. If what's important to understand, and I think that I should, you know, clarify this point as well. Even though the Ukrainian Central Committee had, you know, this legal set of guidelines that were penned by the Germans, which they had to follow very explicitly into the letter, there were also these internal, right, guidelines that were created by many of the nationalists that staffed the Central Committee. And the way that this Ukrainian Central Committee was set up was almost on the classic Führer principle, the Führer principle model of leadership, where you had the main man at the top and you know, the support, and he was the be-all, say-all, and so on and so forth. So that was, you know, the way that or Kubiowicz landed almost in this position to begin with. But when we look at, you know, certain articles in Krakiwski Visti, as you mentioned, or some of the other reports, you know, of Kubiowicz's travels throughout the general government, you know, we see that he's feted in the style of, you know, this kind of national leader or nationalist leader, to kind of the point that he's saluted by school children, you know, or by teachers when he does these inspections, you know, and that gives that aura of this Führer style of leadership. He's also idolized, right, for his name day, St. Volodymyr. You know, Krakiwski Visti had a full page spread on, you know, his achievements, right, and how it was all for the greater good of the Ukrainian nation and so on and so forth. Now, Kubiyovich claimed in his memoirs that he didn't like this, but I think that he certainly got used to it as the war went on, that he got used to being seen as this quintessential leader of the Ukrainian community in the general government. And it's interesting because by 1944, right, when things are even starting to come apart a little bit, he makes that argument. He says that, well, I'm the leader of the Ukrainians in the general government, so I need to have a voice in these matters as well, right? So this kind of, it did, I don't want to use this term, but I think it would be, it's you know, worthwhile to use. It went to his head, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess, you know, what were the alternatives to Frank and Kubiyovich? Like, you know, you're dealing with this in a lot of your later chapters. And again, I'm urging listeners to read the book because we can't possibly cover the richness of your material. But, you know, I'm thinking of one of the mid, I think, or later chapters where things begin coming apart in say like early 1944. And, you know, Kubiyovich is still meeting with Frank because they meet every New Year's Day, I think it is. And so, I mean, is there any evidence from the sources? Because I know the memoirs are not all that reliable, but can you actually get, you know, to the heart of the matter and how Nazi security officials are treating Kubiyovich as the head and pressing these security issues? What exactly happens in that relationship by that later point of the war?
Yeah, well, you know, a lot of it had to do with using his role, using the person of Kubiyovich to kind of being, as you mentioned earlier, right, that middleman between the German administration, the occupation administration, and the Ukrainian community, right? He was almost that valve, right, or middleman that went between them. A lot of, at this time, late 1943, 1944, a lot of what they were pressing him to do was to urge calm, to use his voice to urge calm between the growing conflict between Polish nationalists and Ukrainian nationalists that was taking place in the Galician district, for one, and then in the Lublin district as well, because, of course, this was going contrary to the occupation apparatus, right? It was hurting the occupation regime, hurting its image, and you know, they were pressing on Kubiyovich to use his leverage, contacts, whatever he had, as an added means of trying to calm and quell the situation without having to resort to pacifications and things along those lines, which would only inflame things even more for the Germans. So that was one of the main ways that they decided, or that they used Kubiyovich in that sense. Now, in another way, Kubiyovich was very instrumental as well in his role in urging young Ukrainians to volunteer for the Galician SS division, right? He was the front man, and he played a very prominent role in that, so much so that he even signed, symbolically signed, as it turned out, the first enlistment form, setting the example for many others. But he was very active in traveling around to these different, you know, towns in the Galician district with the German officials, and, you know, organizing these rallies, parades, and things along those lines to really amass the support. And, you know, once it came, or once I realized from the sources why he was doing it, it almost made sense, right? You know, he was in very close contact with Galician District Governor Otto Vechter at the time. And Vechter was someone that came from the old Austrian school, the Habsburg school, if you will. You know, he understood, you know, the Ukrainian dimension in Galicia, the Polish dimension in Galicia. He understood that quite well, and that we have to give him credit for. And you know, he was banking on the Ukrainians to be an added, armed bulwark against the oncoming Red Army. Now, through these different talks, it came out that, you know, Hans Frank and Otto Vechter were convinced that once Ukrainians proved themselves in battle in some way on the front, then, you know, the Ukrainian Central Committee could be possibly, you know, turned into something more political. And that, I think, is what motivated Kubilovich a lot, you know, in 1943 and 1944, to not only quell the situation between Poles and Ukrainians, but to also get Ukrainians, as many as he could, volunteered, trained, armed on the front to prove themselves, to stop, you know, the Red Army advance on Lviv, if only, you know, and be a part of, you know, something bigger.
That was a big question that I had in reading your book, because you know how obsessed I am with maps and geographers and cartographers. I get the impression, you know, and it's really interesting as I think back to Stepan Rudnitsky and the kind of, you know, Galician heritage of racial geography and eugenics and those sorts of things. I wonder if you might, you know, give us a kind of visual impression that you have of Kubilovich in the last kind of stages of the big war of World War II. I have this idea, and the image came to my mind of him just doing a lot of counting, because, you know, in order to think about this territorial project in Eastern Galicia, he had to wait on that counteroffensive that never happened. So, right, I mean, he actually bets on it and wages wrong on the Wehrmacht counteroffensive, which would allow Ukrainians to go back to Galicia and repopulate. So, you know, like, what happens when he realizes he's wrong with a lot of these, you know, sort of collaborating initiatives? Because I don't know. I mean, after the war, obviously, he's going to draw distance from this,
right,
and
I
the
mean,
way he tells the story.
Given. Sure,
right?
Sure.
So I mean, how do you see it? What is your visual impression of him toward the last stages?
You know what? Just one interesting point to piggyback off of what you mentioned earlier, the fact that he bet wrong, right? He bet wrong first and foremost on the Ukrainian involvement in the first major battle at Brody, where they were decimated by the Soviet Red Army. But then it's interesting is because he also bet wrong, as well as you know, some others, on the fact that the Germans would stop the Russian advance through the Tatra Mountains, kind of akin to what happened in World War I, where the Germans stopped the Soviet or the Russian advance there and pushed them back. So he bet wrong on two occasions in that sense. You know, once things started to really show that the Red Army wouldn't be stopped so easily, there was a massive, massive push to get anything and everything that was part of the Ukrainian Central Committee at the local level, at the higher level, people involved, packed up, moved out as far as possible. So we had this kind of the beginning of the migration west, right? And that took the form of various different tracts. A lot of these Ukrainian activists moved through Slovakia and into Austria, some directly into Germany as well. But Kubilovich spent a lot of time going back and forth at this time between Kraków and the general government, what was slowly being left of it, into parts of, you know, Silesia, where certain things were deposited before they were being moved farther west. Into parts of the Reich proper, if you will, and that was kind of the big push to get anything and everything that could fall into Soviet hands out of the way, and you know the Germans facilitated this rather well, you know they facilitated his exit from the general government as well into the Reich proper. You know, providing him with any necessary documentation, things along those lines. So, you know, and once he was there, you know, the Ukrainian Central Committee formally disbanded in 1945, and it was this kind of push to almost repeat what they did, you know, when the Germans invaded Poland in 1939, to form these little committees, little groups, little organizations that would then be kind of a representative before, you know, the next occupiers of Germany. And that was hopefully would be, you know, the Americans and the British for many of the Ukrainians that were coming from the general government.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, finally, this is a really big historiography question, judging from your chapters and from your sources, what would you say are the most promising new, say, empirical research avenues, new pursuits to get the story of Ukrainian nationalism straight? And this is, you know, obviously a leading question, but I'm thinking about how Kubiyovich tried, because he survived the war, to salvage the project. He, you know, discussed people like Fritz Arlt, who were really, you know, racists and exterminationists. And there's no way of you know, avoiding that element of racism and anti-Semitism. But what do you see as a kind of promising research angle for understanding the aftermath of this and the politics of retribution that followed through the 40s?
You know, I know there's a lot of work is being done now, looking at many of those members of OUN, their life after the war, how some of them had links to the CIA and things along those lines. So I think that's a very interesting perspective at the moment. I know Per Anders Rudling is working a lot on that, and that's very, very worthwhile. But as you mentioned, right, you have Grzegorz Rosolinski-Libe, his work, also very good. John Paul Himka goes without question. Jared McBride and many of those others are doing a lot at the moment. So, I can keep going, but
I think, you know, keep going.
And even you know, it's unfortunate a little bit as well that it's only in Polish. But Grzegorz Motyka has done phenomenal work here, and you know, I wish that some of his you know, writings and books would be translated into English, because I think that would provide certainly a great added, added value for Western scholars, especially who maybe aren't too comfortable with Polish.
Mm-hmm. And do you see Kubiyovich's role changing? Because he's guided us through this entire process. And for our listeners who don't know, he's the brains in many ways behind the Encyclopedia of Ukraine, which, you know, was something that so many researchers, you know, just getting started in Ukrainian studies, especially in the 1970s when the Harvard Ukrainian Institute got off the ground, or the Canadian Institute of Ukrainian Studies got off the ground in Alberta. I mean, could you say a few words about not just his memoirs, but let's say why people haven't gone to the 28 volumes in Ottawa and the archives and the files and look through his holdings very carefully?
You know, one of the things that kind of convinces me of that you know, a lot of that has been kind of not taken up, especially by maybe Ukrainian historians, is because the fact that Kubiyovich is so ingrained in many ways, rightly so, as a very, very successful intellectual, academic, scholar, that no one wants to. How should I say this? No one wants to challenge, perhaps, you know, that kind of blind spot that I covered of his activity during the war, right? Because his pre-war story is very interesting, the way he grew up, his experiences in Poland as a Ukrainian, so on and so forth. His post-war experience is very successful, being the pioneer of, you know, the Ukrainian Encyclopedia series. And then there's that small little spot in between that, you know, reading, you know, what I wrote and researching the material sheds a little different light on him. And I think that might be one of the factors where many just weren't comfortable perhaps with trying to, you know, tackle that part of Kubiyovich's life.
Yeah. I like how you put it in the end, and you know, you mentioned the fact that Kubiyovich, and for that matter, the Ukrainian nation and state and national consciousness is not just floating on the tides of history. And I think in this very complicated book, where you get into the heart of so many different nation and state relations, I would urge our listeners to read it very, very carefully. And so my last question for you, Dr. Markievicz, is if you could tell us about your current interests and projects. I know our listeners here at New Books Network and New Books in East European Studies will want to know what you're pursuing.
Well, given the pandemic and things along those lines, it's a little tougher at the moment, but I have, you know, this kind of grand vision where I'd like to maybe return to a topic or a period of time that's always been interesting for me, and that's the post-war period where the communist systems were implemented throughout East Central Europe. And I had this kind of idea, and perhaps I'll continue with it, of writing a history of the recovered territories.
Ziemi odzyskane.
Ziemi odzyskane, yeah. And I think that would be very interesting because that also pulls so many different aspects together. There's a very important Ukrainian aspect in all of that that I'd like to also cover more broadly. So that's kind of the broad vision. What'll come of that, we'll see. But
yeah, zvichaina. Go back to doing some research on my pal Elginius Romer and his family.
Oh, yes, there
you more are. Geographers.
That's right.
Well, thank you so much, for writing this book, and congratulations to you, Pavel. We've been speaking here on New Books Network and New Books in East European History, New Books Diplomatic History, with a new book with author Pavel Markievicz, who has a new book out in the excellent Central European Studies series at Purdue University Press. Pavel Markievicz is our author, and his book is called Unlikely Allies: Nazi German and Ukrainian Nationalist Collaboration in the General Government During World War II, published 2021, Purdue University Press. I've been waiting 20 years for someone to write about Kubiyevich in this way, and I thank you for that and congratulate you. So thank you.
Thanks so much for having me once again, Stephen. It was such a pleasure to talk to you.
And I'm Stephen Siegel here on New Books Network. Until next time.